This episode is proudly supported by LMT, the hospitality industry's preferred source for tabletop and more. Learn more at lmtprovisions.com.
This week on Meat & Three, it's our season four finale, and we're sharing some of our greatest kitchen joys.
Maybe most people consider making it too much work or too messy, but this is the food that's worth the work and worth the wait.
You always know where the thing is because you put it away the right way the first time.
You just sort of stand there and, you know, with your hand on your hip and one leg outstretched, glass of wine in your hand, staring into the refrigerator going, okay, speak to me.
Oh yeah, what are you doing with the celery tonight?
I am making a simple syrup for a gin cocktail with the celery. And I also found a recipe for a celery soup that's going to use up the celery and the potatoes and some of that dill that we still have hanging out in there.
Tune in and be inspired to find the joy in your kitchen. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat & Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to a new season of Why Food, the podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, and this week in particular, creative people who make the food world the interesting place that it is to live and work and eat. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm your co-host, Valerie Lomas.
And we're really excited to be starting a new season.
Yeah.
This is a cool thing.
This is our first season for the fall. I think we both ended out the summer pretty busy. I know, Ethan, you've been harvesting turmeric.
Well, I wasn't harvesting turmeric. Actually, it was not the turmeric harvest season, Valerie. Don't you know that in Nicaragua?
So you were in Nicaragua.
I was in Nicaragua last week visiting turmeric farmers, a couple of co-ops, actually, of farmers growing turmeric in Nicaragua, a place that we're starting to source from. And they're growing incredible turmeric. It's interesting because they don't have a history of growing it. And I think that has allowed a couple of farmers in particular to sort of throw out the older ways, the more traditional ways, the ways the turmeric is grown in other places where it does have a longer history, and kind of start from scratch. And they're doing some really interesting agricultural techniques process.
So we've got some innovation happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Nicaraguan
turmeric. Who knew?
Yeah.
And you were at a writer's retreat. I don't want to jinx anything, but
I mean, of sorts. I spent the end of the summer in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is in the northwest part of Arkansas. And, you know, it's interesting. It's actually a great little progressive pocket. And it's, you know, an artistic hub. And I just had, you know, a little quiet time to work on, you know, developing some recipes and doing some writing. And it was really a great way to end the summer. And I think that's like a great way to segue into our guest today. We've got Chadwick Boyd here. He is a food media entrepreneur, lifestyle expert, and he actually spent the summer kind of celebrating Christmas in July of sorts. Chadwick was actually recording a season. He's a judge on the new show on the Hallmark Channel, where it's a baking cookie competition. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Chadwick, and how you kind of spent the end of your summer?
Well, in most people's terms, I'm the Paul Hollywood of Hallmark.
Wait, so you were a mean judge?
From a Hallmark perspective.
I bet that's a little bit of a lower bar than, like, you know, the PBS Great British Bake Off standard, right?
A little bit different.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. What does it mean to be a mean
judge?
We like
happy holidays kind of thing, but with a little bit of do this and not that.
Okay, I got it. And so for people who might not be fans of Great British Bake Off and know Paul Hollywood, he's like Simon Cowell. So he doesn't really hold back. He tells it how it is. So, you know, can you maybe tell us a little bit about what that was like recording that, Chadwick, and, you know, how that kind of came to be?
Yeah. So it was an amazing time. And, you know, and Valerie, you know this by doing television, that you often don't know what you're walking into when you shoot a television show. And you know it almost immediately by the energy of the people there. and you just show up and do a job and you know what you have to do, even when it may not be the best environment. But it was so incredible. Really, the production value was so high. Everybody was so supportive and helpful. And there were three of us who were carrying the show along with the contestants. It took me back to my childhood and how I started with food, mm-hmm. because my grandmother, Clara, was a baker, mm-hmm. and she trained me first to bake. So by being on set and hearing everybody's stories and the cookies that they made for the competition really took me back to my early years, and it reminded me why I really love to cook and why I'm in food.
Do you think your grandmother would have been a nice judge or a harsh judge if she were judging a show like that?
She would have smiled and giggled while she dropped the hammer.
Okay.
Now were there some like really excellent cookies that you got to taste? Like, did you get inspired by, like, I'm guessing these were amateur bakers and not professionals.
Well, Valerie, I can't give things away. Come on.
I'll take that as a yes. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. And you know, it's so awesome that you had that, you know, television experience. You've actually had quite a bit of television experience, but you've also had some big screen experience. You know, you're the host of Real Food, which is the first kind of like cooking entertainment show that appears in movie theaters nationwide, 15,000 screens. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, that's not the first time I've appeared on a movie screen. So when I was in high school, I was in Dead Poets Society and I was an actor. So it was kind of bringing my food world and my early years together. And Real Food is something that really is a comment on our culture, where food is so much a part of our everyday American culture that why not, instead of crappy ads that come up before previews, entertain everybody? And the one thing in movie theaters, whether you are 2 years old or 92 years old, is that you can agree on food. We can all agree on that, right? And it's the most entertaining, fun thing to do. So Real Food is that thing that comes up, and you know, I just happen to be the one to do that. And I feel really fortunate to do it, but it's so cool to be able to share recipes and ideas that are inspired by the movies that are current, but that get people thinking about what they might want to do with their family and friends once they leave the theater.
What are some of those recipes? What are some of the...
Well, you know what? I have a really great focus group. So I am a proud uncle of 8 now, soon to be 9 in January. And my older set of nieces and nephews are, I think I'm going to get this right, 11 to 14. And they're the most awesome focus group, because if I can pass the muster with them, then I know I'm good in movie theater. So they actually give me ideas. And so my nephew Carter one day said, "Uncle Chadwick, I think you should do Sloppy Joes in the movie theaters." And I was like, "Okay, Carter. Let me think about that." And he loves Sloppy Joes. And I thought, you know, that's so interesting. I haven't had a Sloppy Joe in like 25 years, but I loved them too when I was a kid. So I started to think about, what is it about a Sloppy Joe that I love? And my jowls started to salivate thinking about the vinegar and the brown sugar and the ketchup and the French's yellow mustard like coming together. I'm like, oh my God, I really love a Sloppy Joe. So I reimagined it as a Sloppy Joe burger and creating a sauce to put on top of a burger that had the bell pepper in it and the onions. And he was like, "Oh my God, Uncle Chadwick, yes, do this," right? So that's one that I'm pretty proud of to do. But you know, I've done all kinds of things that are pretty simple for families to do. We sometimes do it regionally. So I did a spicy sweet dipping sauce with chicken, and we did a fried chicken tender version in the South. We did chicken tacos in California in the West. We did wings in the Northeast for, you know, football. So it's fun to think about where people's mindsets are when they go to the movies, because we want to escape when we're there, right?
Was that, was the Sloppy Joe connected to a movie? Was there a cinema connection? That time it wasn't. Just like, this is a good idea, we're going to do
it. Yeah, like, this is just too good. Yeah. And really, it was, you know, sometimes when you create recipes, like when you nail it, like you really nail it. When this came together, I was like, oh my God, this is so good.
Yeah. I mean, that's brilliant. And I love that, you know, your focus group is, you know, it's teenagers, because I think they're like,
and tweens.
Tweens. Yes, yeah, exactly.
I mean, the best, but the worst.
I'm talking about opinions. Come on.
Exactly. Like, they've, right? They've got opinions. And, you know, I think sometimes when we're in this like New York City, big city bubble, you know, it's good to kind of take a step back. And I think that's like a brilliant age, you know, focus group. Like, okay, what are people really like craving? What do people actually want to eat right now? Because, you know, it can be fun maybe for us as recipe developers to kind of like go down this place of, you know, doing something really exciting for us. But like, you know, is your teenager going to eat this?
Oh, come on. I mean, so it's when you have a 12-year-old who is like, Uncle Chadwick, like, this is awesome, right? That is the thing. So if it's coconut oil or sriracha or something like that, like, that's what you want to work with.
Right. That's golden.
Yes.
And so, Chadwick, tell us a little bit about the backstory. How did you wind up in the position that you're in today?
Or Real Dead Food? Poets Society.
Or that, sure, like, that's a good story, too. So,
you were an actor?
I was. Maybe I still am. Law of attraction? I don't know. I've lived a very blessed life, and it was not a path that is a traditional one by any sense. It was never in the very beginning. It never has been. But I think my life has been sparked by curiosity and by creativity. And I'm always thinking about new things to do. I was like that as a kid. So I was with my mother in Charleston for a little getaway. And I was reminded when I was a little kid that my mother would get up on Saturday morning and drive me 45 minutes into a part of on the other side of the city for pottery classes and art classes while other kids were like watching cartoons on TV. And it was all because of my creative curiosity. And we never did anything traditional. So that really is kind of how my path has ended up, where I'm doing these things that I, you know, just happened to cross paths with.
Right. So, you know, you said as a young child, your mother kind of, she nurtured that creative instinct that she saw in you. And what were you seeing of her? Was she a creative person? Was she entrepreneurial? Or?
So I haven't ever told this story, but it's interesting that you asked me that question, Valerie, because while Mama and I were away together, I had another memory of my early years, where she started this side business, which is a flower arranging business. And she would go to these wholesale places and buy ribbon and silk flowers and dried flowers. And she would make flower arrangements for people. And we had this massive workshop downstairs. And I got to just go down and kind of play and be creative. And she had this bazaar in our house where the public would come, and she was selling these things. And I was like, you know, I was 8 years old, and I'm like, I want to get in on this. I want to make some money. So I made these Christmas ornaments out of these pine cones that my grandfather pulled out of the woods. And I don't know where the idea came from. And this would have been, what, 1980? I wrote registered marks of Chad Rap on the tags.
Right. So you branded yourself.
I branded myself.
Wow.
When I was 7 or 8 years old.
Right.
And so my mom and my grandparents together really were always just doing creative stuff around me. And it was, we were never idle. So whether it was cooking or doing something outside, or, you know, an art project, or, you know, ornaments and building a business, you know, that was my everyday.
Did you grow up watching a lot of food TV? Was this a career that you aspired to as a kid?
And when was there, what up, was like the food TV on back?
When I grew up, there wasn't food TV. I'm a lot older than I look. I'll be 48 at the end of October. So they did not have food television, other than the fact, well, let me step back. because I don't want to dishonor somebody who's very important in my life, which who is Natalie Dupree. And Natalie and the Frugal Gourmet were on when I was in the kitchen on Saturdays with my grandmother, Clara. They had this 13-inch black and white television that was up on the counter above our kitchen table. And I have this visceral, emotional memory feeling that my grandmother, Clara, is on one side while we were at the stove cooking, and Natalie is in my left ear on the television behind us. And whenever I hear Natalie's voice, I feel my grandmother, and vice versa. And I always feel that when I walk up to the stove.
So at what age did you sort of conceive of the career that you have now?
Yeah.
When did you realize that this was even feasible?
Or when did pine cone, you were selling ornaments yeah. made from pine cones. When did that become... You know, when did that kind of transfer to...
To a lemonade stand?
To a lemonade stand or like brownies inspired by, I'm sure, a combination of things.
So concurrently, while I was doing the ornament business, which was a seasonal one, I had a refreshment business. And my grandfather built this 6x6 awesome wood little stand that had this awesome peak roof and this ginormous sign. And I would make handcrafted brownies, and I was like, I think 8 years old, and I would do juice and all kinds of stuff, and it was a cash business, and I was making up my menu and doing it then. And so all of that was an expression of my creativity, but I was an entrepreneur. It was a business. And so I just have always kept doing that. I have worked for other, as I got older, I've worked for other businesses. But ultimately, it all was in an entrepreneurial way, because I'm never not doing something that isn't tied to a business venture.
Right. And so, you know, you ended up, you know, you went to college and you studied architecture, right? So I don't know. And you ended up actually, you might have started in architecture, but what kind of happened and where did you end up with what you studied and how has that helped you with the business side of what you're doing today? Because, you know, you're not just, you know, like a TV judge and you don't just do TV segments and food segments. You're building an empire.
Yeah, I am. I truly am. And I mean that with all sincerity. Every day is a day of purpose for me. Interestingly, when I was in middle and high school, my school had drafting, and I thought that was super cool, and I went and did it, but it was also artistic. So I was doing that at the same time as I was acting. And those two things kind of converged to when I was in the Poet Society my senior year in high school, and I chose architecture. And I went to college in North Carolina for that. And I made it a year and a half until all of the engineering and the structure and the math kind of converged. And I was like, I'm out. Yeah, it's not for me. And because it was really my brain works on that side and not with math. But that experience with architecture taught me intention. And to think thoughtfully about something as you're building it, which has continued to serve me every single day. That studying theory of why the great architects have created some of the greatest structures, it all comes down to intention in the very beginning. And that's the inspiration for the design, the look, how it functions, how it serves. And that's how I approach what I do in all the different parts of my company.
What are the other parts of your company? We've talked a little bit about the media side, but what else are you working on?
So I have a brand consulting channel of my company where for 25 years now, I have specialized in working with large consumer brands. And that is just something that I am passionate about doing. I think that... getting to work with large brands and being an outsider, but on the inside, especially somebody who is in food culture, is a great opportunity to create change that serves people better in the end. And I'm always about, how can we make this better? Even when we reach a point where we're like, oh, we did it. It's like, there's always something better, right? So there's that part of my company. There is the brand partnership part where I collaborate with other brands. Valerie, you're familiar with that. You're doing some more of that, which is awesome to see. But that's where I get to be a representative of brands. And one of the things that makes me unique in terms of a talent and expert on air is that I'm able to understand brands on the inside, but I also understand how to connect and how home cooks and everyday people think, and to be able to translate that in a real way, but not in a scripted way, that really brings meaning to everybody. And that is something that I'm committed to doing in all of my work. But I also write for magazines and, you know, there's the whole world of social media, which is now becoming a media channel that we're still trying to figure out. And I think the other part too, which is where Valerie and I connected, is building community. I do culinary salons in my New York space, which was, talk about intention, something that was very important to me when I expanded from Atlanta to come into New York, is I wanted to have a space that was a community gathering space, just like James Beard did in the early days before he was James Beard. I thought that, you know, there's something there about what James did, where he was driven by just pulling all these different people and food together at his table to talk about food and to connect, right? And those were the beginnings of our world of food media and food culture today. And I wanted to create a space that did that now, where when we leave our jobs, that we are still food people who geek out on all kinds of cool stuff and take photos of, you know, what we see at a farmer's market or whatever, and to learn from each other. So building community is as important as the other parts of my business.
How did you, I mean, you've got a lot going on, obviously, and that's something that evolves over time. What was your vision of your career, you know, 20 years ago, and how has it changed since then?
I did not know 20 years ago that I would be doing what I do now. Really, it has been moment by moment where, I'll give an example. So in 2001 and 2002, I merged my business with another brand agency, and the goal was to make it a national company. And it was at the time where brand, people started to talk about it. But we really didn't know what that was. And that meant that companies needed to figure out how to connect with people in different ways. And Panera Bread ended up, they were our primary, our core account. And the CEO at the time was charged with building it into a national chain from this small kind of regional company. And we were like, well, if we need to do this, you need to allow us to do things differently. And as a result, we started to do partnerships with this thing called Food Network, where they were just trying to figure out if people would watch food 24 hours a day. And we pulled in a young budding, quote, celebrity chef, when that phrase didn't exist, of Tyler Florence. And we created this collaboration. And the next thing I know, through that, I'm working with this editor at a publishing house in New York City, and it happened to be Pam Krause. I just knew her as Pam. But I didn't know that it was Pam Krause who created and shaped Martha Stewart and Rachel Ray and Giada De Laurentiis. And that was all driven by my own curiosity. So moment by moment, it led me to where we are in this niche. And had I not felt viscerally drawn to that and was curious about it, I would not be here today.
Yeah, and I, you know, knowing you for a little while now, Chadwick, I think like maybe a year and a half or so, what I find most impressive with how you handle your business and yourself is the community that you've been building, right? The network of people that you are connecting to and that you've been connecting to, you know, over the past couple of decades. I'm curious as to like, is that something that's kind of innate, something that's just within you, this ability to connect with people in a kind of real way? And has that enabled you to build this community that you've built?
I can't imagine food without people. Food really doesn't exist without people connecting. And we were talking earlier where I mentioned that I come from a pure line of farmers. I'm the first one in my family who is not a practicing farmer. All the way back to the 1600s before my family came over, I think, from Wales and Scotland. In my early years being in the farming community, the thing that we did, we grew food and we shared it with others. We fed communities. But we also came together at the table all the time. And so for me, building community and connecting with people cannot happen without food. And food cannot happen without people. And so that is just how I'm wired. But I do feel like people are first. We have to invest in people. And in today's age, I don't think that we spend enough time actually physically connecting with each other. And when we do that, people really feel it, you know, and it changes us.
So are you saying that like a DM on Instagram might not be like the most effective way to kind of build those relationships and communicate? It's better to have that kind of like in-person, real person interaction sometimes.
Well, Valerie, actually, I learned of you on Instagram, and then a week or so later, we met in person. I think they go hand in hand. You just don't rely on the DM and that be it, right? You really make an effort to get to know the person that you're connecting to. Find out where they are. And you know, if food people, we gravitate toward each other. I mean, we sat down and had pizza at Roberta's before we were doing this show, right?
Right.
And that's pretty fantastic. That's what food people do.
Yeah, I mean, so we have a lot more we want to talk about, but should we take a quick break, Ethan?
Yeah, I guess we should take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll be back. Stay tuned.
This episode is proudly supported by LMT, the hospitality industry's preferred partner for sourcing tabletop supplies. From their New York City headquarters, LMT provides expertise and uniquely curated products for restaurants and hotels nationwide. Whether it's dinnerware, glassware, and cutlery, to small wares and equipment, LMT's approach to tasteful design and product knowledge is simply unmatched. Learn more at lmtprovisions.com and listen to founder Morgan Tucker on episode 4 of Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back with Chadwick Boyd, a food media entrepreneur, lifestyle expert,
empire builder,
and also, maybe most importantly, biscuit aficionado.
Biscuit maker.
Biscuit expert, is that fair?
Sure.
I think that's fair.
Biscuit builder. Can we talk about biscuits? Because
call me the biscuit dude. I don't know.
You do so much more than make amazing biscuits, and I've had some of your biscuits, and they are like really unique and special, but you're kind of a biscuit ambassador. So you...
Nobody's ever called me
You
that.
Need a sash, I like think, that. Or a...
Yeah. You helped found a biscuit festival in Knoxville.
I didn't help found it. I helped build it and grow it, yes.
Helped build and grow it.
Yeah.
And you do something called biscuit time, where you've been traveling the country making biscuits with another biscuit
with
expert.
My biscuit boo.
Your biscuit boo, exactly. Biscuit Bay, Carla Hall.
That's right.
And you guys have a really exciting event that you just announced coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So biscuit time is something that Carla and I have been doing this year. We've been traveling to different cities, and it's been really special and wonderful. We've had 300 and 400 people turn out at each one of our programs. And, Carla said this really well not too long ago. She's like, Chadwick, you know, we're not making biscuits together, or we're not breaking biscuits together. We're making biscuits together. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're not breaking bread. We're actually making bread. And the thought there is that we're actually physically doing something together. And that is what biscuit time is about. So yes, we are teaching people how to make biscuits. Carla does her awesome flaky buttermilk biscuits from her soul food book. And I do my clever version, which are my carrot sage biscuits.
I've had those. Oh my God. They are so good. Can people find that recipe on your website?
Yes, actually, you can go to ChadwickBoydLifestyle.com.
Please check out that recipe.
Search it, Google it, and it'll come up. But the whole point in between is we share life lessons and we get people involved, and it just everyone's smiling, just having a really good time. But what we've added, which is coming up, what's today? Thursday? It's Thursday.
It is Thursday, September 5th.
A week from tomorrow, Carla and I will be in San Antonio at Fort Houston. Doing a USO appearance. We are adding a military family component to this, which I just got goosebumps as I said that. It's something that's very dear to me. My grandfather, who was my greatest teacher, was a prisoner of war in World War II. He was captured in the Battle of the Bulge, and he was Army 101st Airborne. And this is something that I know he would just smile and be so proud that we're doing this and that I'm making biscuits with military families. But it's also my way of giving back to him. I'm a little emotional about that. I love my grandfather, and he is why I do what I do. We are creating special moments together that for families that really don't get to do that very much these days. And making biscuits together is pretty darn good.
I actually have a question. Can anyone make a biscuit?
Oh, I'm going to get myself in trouble for answering that. Fundamentally, everybody should be able to make a biscuit. I have seen some biscuits that aren't that great. But in all seriousness, the only reason why they aren't that great is because they believe in their mind before they make it that they're not going to succeed at it.
Oh, that's deep right there. Please say more.
And I think that actually is tied to cooking. It's one of the things that frustrates me. I talked about Natalie Dupree earlier, and one of the things that she and I share is that we are champions for home cooks. People do not get into the kitchen to cook because they think or somebody has told them that they can't cook, which really is not true. We can all take a few things and make something if we are properly shown and we have a little spark of believing that we can do it. And most people have at least one thing that they can cook well and feel really good about. So I've seen that even through our Biscuit Time program, where people are like, I never was able to do really great biscuits, or I never felt comfortable doing them, or I was intimidated by it. And the cool thing about Biscuit Time is that people are going back into their kitchens and going on Instagram and taking pictures of what they're doing. They're like, we did it. And it's so cool. It's great.
What's the significance of the biscuit in particular? Why is that the iconic dish that you're making?
Because they're pretty simple. There are only a few ingredients that go into biscuits. And it's something that was part of my early years. It's something that is part of Carla's early years. And Carla does something that she makes biscuits for strangers. Like, she will walk up to anybody on the street, literally does not know them, and like, hey, you want to make some biscuits? And we'll go back to their house or bring them back to her apartment and make biscuits. I do that with people that I kind of sort of know. I'm not as bold as that. But the great thing is that making biscuits with people that you don't know brings all these walls down and gets us connecting together. And the cool thing is when people are like, oh my gosh, I never thought I could make them. But they really are flour, butter, you know, a fat, some salt and leavening.
Yeah. And I mean, okay, so you've made, well, Carla's made biscuits with strangers. You've made biscuits with...
somewhat strangers.
somewhere between acquaintances and strangers. But you've also, aside from Carla, who's obviously, you know, amazing and an idol of mine personally, you've cooked with some pretty interesting people and celebrities and particularly like country music stars. I mean, a lot of people might not know about me. I actually really love country music. I've been to Dollywood and I saw like the Biscuit Festival used to be in Knoxville and you ended up cooking with Dolly Parton.
I didn't cook directly with Dolly.
Okay.
That almost happened. but the Biscuit Festival was founded in Knoxville, Tennessee. And it was established there, 25,000 people for 9 years would show up. It was awesome. And that, you're from Louisiana.
Yeah, I'm from the South. We eat biscuits.
Yeah. Tennessee, Ethan, we need to get you down there.
Yeah. We'll just bring you some biscuits.
I'm a New Yorker.
Maybe Chadwick will make biscuits with you, Ethan.
Oh, yeah, all right.
Deal. I should have brought biscuits.
You should have brought biscuits.
I didn't know that we were going to be talking about biscuits.
Of course we're talking about biscuits.
but, you know, that part of Tennessee is has incredible people and the folks at Blackberry Farm and all of that. When we started to get behind the Biscuit Festival, we had a branch off of it called the Southern Food Writing Conference. And literally it was this convening of all of these awesome people from in the food world and pop culture to celebrate the biscuit for one Saturday in May. And I was very fortunate that I got to make biscuits and connect with some pretty incredible people.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's like one kind of big thing I want to make sure that we don't forget to mention. You know, you said you started off, you know, studying architecture. You ended up getting a degree in English. And it's like, who knew that would have ended up really preparing you for the food industry, but you are a cookbook author of a book that's now in its sixth printing, which is incredibly impressive with a cookbook, Entertaining with Vegetables.
And self-published.
And self-published. Wow.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you've contributed to pretty much every lifestyle magazine out there, from Better Homes and Gardens to Rachel Ray. Can you just maybe tell us a little bit about where the writing fits into everything else that you do in media?
The writing fits in as the second thing that I do every single day. When I wake up, I spend a bit of time in prayer and quiet time, meditative time, and then I write. I have notebooks that I... just write down ideas and thoughts sometimes that they are inspirations that come to me that become stories or recipes or concepts for other things. So writing is something that I have always done. It's something that I have done since I was a kid. And it just, you know, whether it was architecture or writing cookbooks or working for magazines, there's something about it for me that I just can't not do. And ultimately where I am now is that I love being able to share it. So, you know, the beautiful thing about social media is that it is a form of writing. So I parlay what I handwrite sometimes into the posts that I have. That's where the inspirations come from.
Food media has changed a lot since you started your career. What are some of the key ways that you've seen it shift, and what advice would you give to a someone trying to start a career in food media today?
Oh, gosh. Where to start on that one? I think food media is such a... It's a small phrase, but a big thing that continues to expand and evolve. And pretty much anybody can participate in it, whether you just, you know, love going out with your family and, you know, taking pictures and putting them on Instagram. That's a form of food media. And interestingly, that's now connected to Food & Wine magazine and Bon Appetit and Better Homes & Gardens, which weren't before. And that happens so quickly. One of the things that, from a television standpoint, I share a frustration with a lot of people, is that food television is driven by entertainment rather than instruction. And I miss that. I understand ratings and viewership and, you know, ad sales and all that stuff, the business side. But I really miss that part. And I miss that there are people who say that they're in food media, but they really haven't taken the time to study and to better themselves. They think that they're an expert just because, you know, they see certain things on social media or that they hear about it on television, but that doesn't necessarily make it true or right or good. So I think that's my frustration with it. But, you know, the flip side of that is food is everything. It is a part of our lives. And in America and around the world, it's a part of our everyday. And that's an incredible thing. That was not the case when I was younger in the mainstream. But now we can go and we can get beautiful mangoes if we wanted just by going on our phones and buying them. That wouldn't happen 25 years ago when I was growing up. But I think it's an exciting thing. It allows us to do what we do here. And the beautiful thing is that there are listeners and people who tune in and are interested and they share it and we are inspired by each other. That's cool. And that's what gets me going.
So what, how should an aspiring food media person or, entrepreneur, where should they get started today?
I think just by, being better every day, like committing to like what you do well, whether you write or you cook or write recipes, find your channel and then connect yourself to good people who, do things better than you do and ask them questions. Sarah Foster, I've been out of, from Foster's Market in Durham, North Carolina. I was one of her first customers when she opened up 27 years ago and ended up working with her on her cookbooks. Sarah taught me how to write a really good recipe for a home cook. I could not do that before that. So I encourage anybody to get connected to their Sarah Foster, who is open and willing to make you better and continue to do at it. And the beautiful thing is that once you find somebody like my Sarah Foster, that leads to other people and you can branch out and grow from there.
Yeah, I love that advice, basically. Like, get someone who will invest in you becoming a better person, whether that's a mentor. And, you know, it's a two-way street. It's something that works both ways, and that can kind of open the next door for...
Yeah, and I want to add something on to that, because I think what I see in young people is that there is this, like, give me something. There's this attitude of like, give this to me. It has to be an exchange. And you're reaching out to that person has to be genuine, and you have to engage in that relationship as much as that person gives to you. And I do see, Ethan, you've asked about frustrations in younger people. I do see that a lot. They come up to me and have that, and it really bothers me. Food is an exchange. And if you're going to be in this world, you have to be willing to give and receive.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point, because even, I mean, I feel like a lot of people who make food for other people, it's like you're giving it to someone out of love. But there is still that exchange of, like, you know, they give you back appreciation and gratitude. And when it comes to a mentor, especially with, like, Generation Z, for example, like, I mean, the way that they think about things and the way that they understand things like YouTube and just sharing that information. If someone is like an aspiring, you know, food media person, just sharing that information with their mentor can be extremely valuable. So I love what you said about that. Like, you know, food is a two-way street.
Valerie, who's been your mentor in your early days of exploring a career in food media?
You know, that's such a funny question because, I mean, I was an attorney for 8 years. I kind of still am.
Aren't you always an attorney?
I mean, once an attorney. As long as those bar dues get paid, right? And it's so funny because I felt like I never had a mentor. And as soon as I was kind of like thrust into this industry that I think is significantly more difficult to break into, you know, I was really blessed to just meet some people that reached out to me, people like Dana Cowan. She reached out to me to appear on her show, Speaking Broadly, on Heritage Radio Network. And, you know, she ended up being someone who I could reach out to. And Julia Tertian, Kat Kinsman, Jamila Robinson, Adrian Miller. These are all people. It's like I now have that community of people, Nancy Hopkins, that I can reach out to, and they really pour into me. And I try, you know, when I can, to make sure that that it is a two-way street, because everyone has something that they can offer to other people. So,
and I think to add on to that too, when you are earnest and genuine in that, know that you have something to offer them. Because I see this a lot also, the flip side of younger people, they're scared to go up to people who are very well established and known. And I've seen moments where it makes their days when somebody young comes up and really is genuine about talking to them. I think a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to talk to somebody who is a name, right? But they're people too, and they share the same desires and loves about food as everybody else.
Yeah, and I think we all just want to have that conversation with other people who love food. And, you know, we went to the IACP conference in Santa Fe, where there are legends there, like Natalie Dupree. I had never met her, like Jessica Harris. I had only met her briefly, but to have the opportunity to, you know, converse with them, it's something that, you know, we're both hungry for. So that's a really great point, Chadwick.
In the last few minutes of our interview, we do our fun rapid fire segment.
Chadwick is a little, he's holding his hand up like, please don't.
Start with an easy one. What did you eat for lunch as a kid? What was your like favorite school lunch or weekday lunch?
Ooh, it's something odd. I made soup. I made chicken corn soup. It was the first recipe that I really mastered.
How old were you?
8. And it was Swanson canned chicken, two cans of broth, a small can of creamed corn, and I would mix them together, bring it to a boil, add salt and pepper, and I thought it was amazing.
You work for an 8-year-old? That's pretty yes. sophisticated.
I'm like, and you seasoned it. Very yeah. important, right? If we could all just learn simple things. But also, okay, I guess I'm up. Favorite vegetable?
Celery.
Controversial choice.
I freaking love celery. I wrote a story about this for Keith Pandolfi in Serious Eats called Celery is My Star. And celery lights my fire. I also have celery Gruyere biscuits on Rachel Ray's, the magazine website, that are rocking, y'all. And they're drop biscuits, so they're easy to make. I love that it polarizes people, but I love the crunch. I love that you can soften it and that it can be eaten as an actual vegetable instead of like a little additive to something else. It lights me up. All right. It's my thing.
If you could master any skill overnight, what would it be?
Ooh, overnight.
Wake up tomorrow morning and be the best blank.
Oh, you know, I really wish that I had incredible knife skills. Mm. Like the real, like, who is that? The Morimoto or, like, I wish I had that speed.
That's a great answer. I actually cut my finger today chopping something, which is pretty embarrassing. So I probably need that too. But I guess we'll wrap it up. Favorite or kitchen utensil you can't live without?
A zester.
What are some of the less obvious uses for a microplane that you've
come across? I use microplane for cheese. I like cheese, but I also like to watch how much I eat. And a microplane allows me to get that layer of cheesy taste without a ton of fat and calories. So that's what I use it for. But I use it for salt. Like I think in my test kitchen, we've got like 8 of them, and they're always being used.
You have on a little holster or something.
Yeah, they're in my demo kit. Oh, yeah. In my knife kit, I have a zester. Yeah,
there you go.
No, that's a great tip. Use it for grating cheese so that you can kind of watch the amount of calories that you're getting.
It makes the cheese look beautiful. You get this like pillowy cloud
of
cheese.
It's so good.
Well, Chadwick, thank you so much for joining us. Where can our listeners find out more about you, about your work, read some of your recipes, watch some of the TV?
So we'll soon have a new website, chadwickboydlifestyle.com. You can find me on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Chadwick Boyd. I'd love to have a conversation with anybody. And, we've got some really cool stuff coming up too. Can I drop something?
Please. Sure.
So I've got a biscuit story coming out in Rachel Ray's magazine.
Very cool.
Next week. It's awesome.
So will that be the October issue?
It is the October issue.
All right. October issue of exciting. Rachel Ray magazine, everyone.
Yes. Pick it up.
And as always, you can reach us via our email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. or on all the socials at Why Food Podcast. You can reach me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can reach me on Instagram at Foodie in New York.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, y'all.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.